This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Jimmy Webb was one of the most prolific and successful songwriters of the 1960s and 70s. Glenn Campbell had big hits with his songs By the Time I Get to Phoenix, The Wichita Lineman, and Galveston. Webb's other hits include Didn't We, Up, Up, and Away, The Worst That Could Happen, and MacArthur Park, which was recorded by Richard Harris, The Four Tops, and Donna Summer, to name just a few of the hundreds of recordings of that tune. Jimmy Webb has a new album of duets he recorded with some of the artists he's written for over the years. Here he is with Linda Ronstadt. The song is All I Know.
I bruise you, you bruise me. We both bruise so easily, too easily. To let it show I love you, and it's all I know. All my plans keep falling through. All my plans, they depend on you, depend on you. Help them grow. I love you, and it's all I know. When the singer's gone, let the song go. It's a fine line between the darkness and the dawn. They say in the darkest night there's a light beyond, but the ending always comes at last.
Jimmy Webb and Linda Ronstadt from Webb's new album called Just Across the River. Terry spoke to Jimmy Webb in 2004.
Let's talk about one of your best-known songs, and that is By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I was reading this is the third most performed song in the last 50 years, according to BMI, who should know. How did you write the song?
Well, it's more of a song about something I wish I had done than something I really did, in that I did not get in my car and drive back to Oklahoma to punish this young woman for not reciprocating my love and affection. In fact, a guy approached me one night after a concert, and he had a map, and he had all the times, and he had a stopwatch, and he showed me how it was impossible for me to drive from L.A. to Phoenix, and then how far it was to Albuquerque. And then, in short, he told me, this song is impossible. And so it is. It's a kind of fantasy about something I wish I would have done, and it sort of takes place in a twilight zone of reality. I hasten to add that I think that the appeal of the song lies in its sort of succinct tale, its beginning, middle, and end, and the fact that it sort of has an O. Henry-esque twist at the end, which consists merely of the guy saying, she didn't really think that I would go, but he did. And in fact, I didn't. I didn't go. I stayed for more punishment.
Does the woman or girl, I don't know how old you were, that you wrote this for, know that it was about her?
Oh, yes, she does. And she's still, thankfully, she's very much alive And she's actually married into the Ronstadt clan. Her name is Susan Ronstadt now.
Huh.
And she and I are very, very close friends. And there were many, many songs that were inspired by her and came about as a result of our very young relationship. High school. She was a high school sweetheart. We actually went to Disneyland together on graduation night, and that picture still exists, unfortunately. I was wearing the worst sort of plaid sports jacket you had ever seen in your life.
It sounds like this torch is still dimly burning.
Well, I believe that all torches are inextinguishable to some degree, no matter what human beings say about that subject. And I just do believe that once that fire is kindled, it lasts forever. You do love that person forever.
Well, I think this would be a good time to hear the Glen Campbell version of By the Time I Get to Phoenix, written by my guest, Jimmy Webb.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, 'cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing. That's all. By the time I make Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping.
By the time I got to Phoenix, started a short series of place songs, you know, Galveston, Wichita, mm-hmm. Lineman. Did you start to think that if you put a place name in the song that it would hit?
No, it wasn't so much my doing as it was deliberate manipulation on the part of A&R and the labels and in their attempts to engineer what we called in those days a follow-up record. But I remember particularly the day that they called me about Wichita and said, Glenn's looking for a follow-up for By the Time I Get to Phoenix, but it's got to be a place. And I thought, well, okay. I didn't particularly like that idea. I'm not someone who thinks that way or creates that way. But I'm a young songwriter, and I think I've got the chops to do it, and I sit down and I spend maybe an hour and 45 minutes or 2 hours working on a song. I come up with a concept based on some memories I have of some blue-collar guys working on telephone lines around Liberal Kansas and the panhandle of Oklahoma out there in that great kind of land of no horizon. And I called them up, and I said, I've got a song over here. I said, but I don't really think it's finished. And they said, well, send it over anyway. And I sent it over, and they called me back in a state of exaltation over what I had written. And they put it out, and it became this huge hit. And this song people still tell me, and it bothers me a little bit, because when I was writing my book on songwriting, Tunesmith, I actually, for the first time, analyzed some of my songs, and I was really shocked and appalled at what I found. And one of the things that I found was that in Wichita Lineman, there's a line that goes like this, and I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita Lineman is still on the line. And the first thing I thought of when I read it is false rhyme. That's a false rhyme. That's
line
the
and
biggest,
time.
That's the most biggest, awfulest, dumbest, most obvious false rhyme in history. And night after night, at performance after performance, person after person comes up to me. Until now, I'm talking about 100,000 people have walked up to me and said, you know the greatest line you ever wrote? I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time, you know? And so I don't know how to explain that. I wouldn't have, had I known what I was doing, I wouldn't have written that line. I would have found a way to make it rhyme. It was only years later that I became aware of what a songwriter was even supposed to do. I was really just a kid who was kind of writing from the hip and the heart.
Why don't we hear Freddie Johnson's version of that? You familiar with the version?
I've heard it, and I like it.
Good, me too. Let's hear it.
I am a lineman for the county, and I ride the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wires, I hear you through the wire, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. You know I need a short vacation, but it don't look like snows that stretch down south will never take the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita still on the line.
Now, you grew up in Oklahoma. Your father was a Baptist minister. How did the church figure into your daily life and into your musical life as a child?
It was a totally all-encompassing influence, in that when you're the son of a Southern Baptist minister, you are informed at a very early age that you are part and parcel of his ministry, and that your behavior reflects on his image in the community, and therefore your every movement, your every word, everything that you do is monitored. And that includes the music that you play, the music that you listen to. And my mother's dream from the very beginning, when she started me on piano at 6 years of age, was that I would be church pianist. And I was. By the time I was 12 years old, I was the church pianist. And I had also moved over to organ and was a large part of the musical program in the church. And we did specials. We sang three-part. My father played guitar. My mother played accordion. I can just remember the top of my mother's head sticking over this big Hohner accordion. She was short, and the accordion was taller than she was.
Now, your family moved to Southern California, to San Bernardino, in 1964. Did your father get a church there?
Yes. He was pastoring in Colton. And I finished my high school in Colton. I graduated as a senior from Colton High School. It was the year that JFK was assassinated. And it was also the year that my mother died. And so it was really quite an eye-opener for me. And it's interesting to note that my mother, after expending these huge reserves of energy, sort of lashing me into a somewhat formidable young musician, that she died before I ever did anything. She never heard me. She never heard one of my songs on the radio. She never saw me get one award. She never saw one piece of sheet music on the piano with my name on it. I have regrets about that, because had she lived just a little bit longer, I think she would have been really proud of me, you know?
Mm-hmm, sure.
So all of a sudden I was exposed to the Beach Boys, which was like, it was like a fish to water. I mean, I loved Southern California. I loved the lifestyle. I loved the Beach Boys. I loved the Righteous Brothers. And I just wanted to get into it. I wanted to get into the record business.
Did your father love you
stop,
doing that?
You know, no, he didn't. And because one of the precepts of the Baptist Church, Terry, is that we do not believe in dancing. The Southern Baptist Church does not believe in dancing. In fact, Glenn Campbell told me a story once. He said, Jimmy, he says, you know why Baptists don't make love standing up, don't you? And I said, no, how come? He says, because they're afraid people will think they're dancing. That's kind of a typical Glenn Campbell story. I think it's a pretty good one.
The year your mother died, your father moved back to Oklahoma. Did he want, you didn't, you stayed in California. Did your father want you to go with him?
He sure did. I remember we were standing in San Bernardino, California, in the parking lot of the Palm Paradise Palm Motel. And my dad had the car packed, and he and my sisters, my brothers was in the car. And I was standing there, and I said, Dad, I'm not going. I said, there's no way in the world that I'm going back to Oklahoma after coming all this way and being this close to Hollywood. I just have to try it. I have to try it. He said, son, he said, this songwriting thing, he says, it's just going to break your heart. And P.S., he was right about that more than once. But he said, but, and he dug down in his pocket, and he came up with $40. And he said, son, he says, this is all I've got. But he says, it's yours. And he gave me $40, and he got in his caravan, his little trailer truck thing, and off he went. And that was a lonely, very isolated moment in time, standing there in a parking lot with these neon lights blinking, these kind of electronic palm trees blinking on and off over my head, going, now what have I done? How am I going to handle this?
You started writing hit songs at an interesting time in the history of radio. You know, we're talking the latter part of the 1960s. So it's a time when you still have pop music on AM and you have the beginnings of, you know, quote, progressive rock on the FM. And
underground, we used to call it.
Underground, yeah. So your songs were falling a bit on both, weren't they?
I was very fortunate that way. If it hadn't been for FM, quote, underground, unquote, radio, MacArthur Park would have never been broken as a single, because Top 40 was not going to play MacArthur Park. It was 7 minutes and 20 seconds long. Parentheses, and Hey Jude is 7 minutes, 21 seconds long. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. But MacArthur Park would never have broken on Top 40. And in fact, I remember Ron Jacobs calling me from KHJ in Los Angeles and saying, we'll go on MacArthur Park, but you have to edit it for us. And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. And they said, well, you realize what you're doing. I mean, you're throwing away a hit record. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to edit it, because that's what it is. And a week later, they were on it. And as soon as stations like KHJ started playing MacArthur Park in its entirety, forget it. It rolled across the country. It was inescapable.
MacArthur Park and Stairway to Heaven are two of the most, like, baffling lyrics in, in the history of pop songs. So let's go over the lyric a little bit. You know, MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing melting down.
Flowing down.
Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can make it, but it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
I don't think that I can take it because it took so long to bake it. Anyway, you can freely substitute. I don't really think it matters that much.
What were you thinking about when you wrote this? What is it?
Well, I was thinking about the end of a love affair, in a very lurid sort of melodramatic terms, because this whole love affair had taken place in and about the environs of MacArthur Park in Los Angeles, which in those days was this kind of lovely little park with ducks and things. Now it's like I don't know what it is. I think it's even smaller. I think they've chopped it down into a smaller piece of real estate. But there were boats there, and it passed for a romantic place when one was a teenager. And so really, I make no defense of the lyrics of MacArthur Park. They were written in a hallucinogenic era when actually such lyrics are quite common, and most of them don't need to be defended. It was an era of that kind of thing.
So you're using the psychedelic defense.
Well, it's not even a defense. I think I stand by MacArthur Park. I think that it's completely unique, and it is a very viable attempt to coalesce rock and classical music and sort of format something for the radio that has movements, that has a kind of grandiose symphonic feeling to it. I'm really not, and I did the arrangement myself. I won a Grammy for it. I don't think there's anything to defend, really. It was just part of a lot of kind of careless lyric writing.
It's interesting, you know, it does have this kind of like trippy lyric about the cake melting in the rain and everything. And, you know, Richard Harris had the hit, and he, you know, I don't think he struck anybody as being particularly of, you know, like the groovy psychedelic era. So it was kind of odd matching in a way.
He thought he was.
Mm-hmm. Well, judging from, I'm looking at the album jacket of the CD reissue, and I don't know if this is the same thing that was on the album, but there's a picture of him in a park. I don't know if it's the park.
Yeah.
Wearing like a black robe.
Looking very sullen.
Yes, is seated in this kind of throne with a red headband tied around his forehead.
Yeah, he saw himself that way too. He always saw himself on a throne. In fact, he ended his career playing kings. He played Caesar and then in Harry Potter, he was playing sort of the king of the magicians, but he was a king, and to me, even though I think I could say without fear of contradiction that this much maligned song MacArthur Park has been recorded probably 200 or 300 times by everybody from the Four Tops to Frank Sinatra but my favorite version of it is still Richard Harris's.
Did he want to ask you anything about the song before he actually recorded it?
No. You know what he said? He said, "I'll have that."
He was talking about striped pants in the lyrics, and he says striped. Did you want him to say striped?
I can give you something much better than that. The name of the song is MacArthur Park. All the way through, he sung MacArthur's Park. MacArthur's Park is melting into that. He sung MacArthur's Park, and he couldn't be dissuaded from that. I've had artists change my lyrics throughout my whole career in that way, and sometimes they get something in their head and you can't get it out.
Well, let's hear Richard Harris's version of your song, MacArthur Park.
Oh, let's do.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages, and we're pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no. I recall the yellow cotton dress foaming like a wave.
That's Richard Harris's hit recording of MacArthur Park, a song written by my guest, Jimmy Webb. What did you think when Donna Summer had her hit disco version of MacArthur Park?
Well, first of all, I was not a great disco fan, but I am a great Donna Summer fan, and I think she's got these great pipes, and she really sang the song. It was also just from a purely financial point of view. It was, and this is probably one of those asterisk quotes at the bottom of my career somewhere. It was the only number one record I've ever had in the United States.
Really?
And I remember, yes, because everything else, through my heyday, I was battling the Beatles, and the Beatles quite often held down the top three spots, sometimes the top five. MacArthur Park was kept out of number one by a Beatles record. I don't remember which one it was, but they just sat there. They just sat there for 16 weeks and kept us out of number one. So MacArthur Park was never higher than two with a bullet with Richard Harris. And a lot of those records were stuck either in the top 10 or in the high teens, because the Beatles held down so many slots. And here it was, finally, my first number one record.
Do you see yourself as straddling different eras, you know, of having like one foot in the rock era and one foot in the popular song era?
Oh, I think it's inescapable. I think it's absolutely true, and in many ways I've been fortunate because of that, because I've had a breadth of experience. The artists that I was conversant with, the fact that Johnny Mercer would call me up and ask me if I was interested in writing a song with him, is quite incredible when you place it alongside. For instance, the fact that Lowell George, who founded Little Feat, recorded one of my songs on his solo album, and that I played piano on Jumpin' to the Fire on Nielsen Schmielsen, and that my first song was recorded by the Supremes. It was a Christmas song called My Christmas Tree. And so I've been almost extraordinarily fortunate to have been able to live in those two worlds and to intimately embrace those two worlds, to have been at the recording session in London when the Beatles recorded Honey Pie, to have been sitting there watching them play. So it is... It's really, if variety is the spice of life, then, you know, my life has been well seasoned.
Jimmy Webb, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a long time dream of mine to talk to you, Terry.
I'm honored to hear you say that. Thank you.
Because the spot is melting in the dark.
Donna Summer's 1978 recording of Jimmy Webb's song MacArthur Park. It was her first number one single. Jimmy Webb spoke with Terry Gross in 2004. He has a new album of duets he's recorded with some of the artists he's written for over the years. It's called Just Across the River. You can hear three tracks from his new CD at our website, freshair.npr.org. When the TV series Mad Men drew to a close last season, there were big changes in store for the advertising agency Sterling Cooper. The most powerful people at the agency, Don Draper, Roger Sterling, and Burt Cooper, had hatched a plan to break away from their British parent company to start their own firm. They sought help from British executive Lane Price, the only person with the authority to sever their contracts. Here's a scene from the last episode of last season. Price is with Draper, Sterling, and Cooper going over their plan.
If I were to send a telex in at noon today that you've all been sacked, it's after close of business in London. It would remain unnoticed until Monday morning there, 2 a.m. here. That gives us today and the weekend to first gather accounts and then a skeleton staff to service them. And, of course, we would have to obtain all the materials required for continuity of service.
Obtain? We have to steal everything.
Anyone approached must be a certainty. If news spreads, they'll lock us out.
Do we vote or something?
Well, gentlemen, I suppose you're fired.
Well, it's official. Friday, December 13th, 1963. Four guys shot their own legs off.
The British executive Lane Price, who helps mastermind the breakaway, is played by Jared Harris. He's the son of the late actor Richard Harris, who, in between his roles playing kings and aristocrats, had the 1968 hit of Jimmy Webb's MacArthur Park. And Jared Harris's stepfather was Rex Harrison. Before being cast in Mad Men, Jared Harris's film roles included I Shot Andy Warhol, Happiness, and The Other Boleyn Girl. And he had a recurring role in the FX series The Riches. Terry spoke to Harris in 2001. Since we've been on the topic of MacArthur Park, let's begin our interview excerpt there.
What did you think of the record when it came out, and what was happening in your life that year, 1968?
And during my first year in prisoner of war camp, that was a private school called Lady Cross.
It was like a high school?
Yeah, it was a boarding school.
So everybody in the school must have known this. Did this help or hurt your reputation?
I remember seeing him on Top of the Pops singing My Boy, but not that one.
Well, I guess it wasn't that big in England, huh?
No, it was, but it wasn't, I was at a boarding school, you know, you didn't have radios, you weren't allowed to watch television, you didn't have access to you know, where would you hear it? You didn't have little record players or CDs or anything like that.
Well, when you saw your father and your stepfather acting, was it acting or the actor's life that you found appealing?
I wasn't aware of my dad being an actor when I was young. There was an Australian children's entertainer on television called Rolf Harris, and when I'd say my father was an actor, the kids would say, you know, oh, is he Rolf Harris? I'd say no, and then they would lose interest. So I was disappointed he wasn't Rolf Harris for a long time. But I wasn't aware of him as an actor. I had the benefit of both his success and my stepfather's success in being privileged to go and see a lot of the world when I was very young, you know. So that rubbed off, a taste for that rubbed off, definitely.
What were the Richard Harris and Rex Harrison movies that made the biggest impression on you when you were young?
I remember seeing Camelot. I do remember seeing Camelot and a film called The Snow Goose.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the first films he made that kids could go and see. My father mostly was in mature themed movies. Rex, I remember seeing him in Cleopatra. He played Caesar opposite.
That must have been fun.
Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, I loved Cleopatra was great fun with all these battles and everything.
When you started acting, did you feel that there was anything you had to live up to from your father and stepfather's reputation, or that you would be compared to them in any way?
Well, obviously compared myself. It was important to me to establish myself on my own terms. I had opportunities to act with him very early on. In the movie The Field, they had trouble finding somebody, and I was talking to the director about playing his son in The Field, and he was leery of it, and so was I. And it was important to me for me to be established and recognized on my own right before I went and went down that route, you know, tried to coattail, you know. I didn't want to do that. Otherwise, you know, I wanted to fail on my own terms. If I was used, you don't know if you got, everybody has to think that they've got something special to get into this, because the chances of succeeding are so slim. If I had nothing special and I was going to fail, then I wanted to do it on my own terms and rather than sort of be fooled, you know.
Was there anything that you'd seen in your father or stepfather's careers that either influenced you or convinced you to do it differently?
Well, Rex had, and my father still has, incredibly successful, varied careers. So I'd be thrilled if I could get mine up to that kind of a level. I think the lesson that I remind myself is it's not giving up. You know, they didn't want Rex Harrison to play the part of Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady when they were going to make the movie. They didn't want him for it. He'd played it on Broadway and he'd played it in the West End. But he wasn't a movie star. And so they were going to get somebody else. And they, of course, were campaigning for him to play this part. And so they demanded that he audition for it and send a photograph of himself in, you know. And they were trying to, you know, they put him through some fairly humiliating, or attempted to put him through some humiliating hoops to get this part. And he sent a photo of himself straddling over one of those little fountain, you know, those boys that piss into a fountain, you know. And he sent that in as his picture. They didn't want my father for the role in Camelot either, to play King Arthur. They wanted Richard Burton, and when he turned it down, they were going elsewhere, and he campaigned like hell to get that part. I mean, even to the point of tracking down Jack Warner in some party out in Palm Springs to convince him to give him a shot at this role, you know? So those are the things that I remember. When you see something that you know you're right for, go after it, and not to give up while you still have that the desire and the ambition.
The movie that I think you first became really known for was I Shot Andy Warhol in 1996. And this movie is about Valerie Solanas, who wrote the Scum Manifesto and actually shot Andy Warhol, seriously wounding him and nearly killing him. Lily Taylor played Valerie Solanas. You played Andy Warhol. How did you get the part?
I auditioned. You know, I knew it was a part that they would cast an English-speaking actor, I mean, an English actor for. Generally, when you're over here, if you're English, you tend to get the parts that, well, this sounds a bit silly, not that nobody wants, but, you know, you get the kind of odd parts, the character parts, or the sort of the kind of the villain parts. So I knew this was an American role, which was an important thing for a foreign actor working this country to get, is to try and get your first American roles, you know. So I was all gung-ho to try and land this part and played some little mind games to get it.
What did you do for the audition?
You know, I went in and met them first, and I had a beard and everything, and I deliberately tried to look as unlike the guy as I could, and then said I'd like to come in, but don't ask me to come back in 2 days' time or 3 days' time. I said, give me 2 weeks or 3 weeks to really focus on this and try and get it right, and you'll have an idea of how close I can get. And and if you've got any material, the tapes and stuff like that, and I'd love to get that, because that'll give me a cut short my that process. So, which is what I did. I studied for a couple of weeks, and I came into the audition, and I thought it would be too weird if I sat down talking as I do now and then suddenly put on this persona. So I went in and did the whole thing as Andy. And then I thought, well, he would do something to try and flip the tables on these people, because he didn't like to be put on. He liked to be in the spotlight, but not having it pointing at him. He liked to be pointing the spotlight. So I was trying to figure out how to turn the tables, and I got hold of a little video camera and made a movie of them auditioning me.
Now, you play Andy Warhol as if he's pretty disconnected from his body, and almost as if his body doesn't have much weight or energy.
I thought that's true, looking at the photos of him and seeing him move around. I think he'd become pretty disappointed in his sexual experiences, and I think he hated the way he looked, and he hated his body. He didn't like the way it looked. As before he got shot, the thing, he's deteriorated greatly after he got shot. But I also noticed that in all of his pictures, he always covered up his crotch.
Huh.
You always see him the way he stands. He's always sort of covering it up.
Gee, what does that mean
himself.
To you?
I think that he was uncomfortable and was disappointed in the act of sex, and was in some way disappointed in his physical being, you know.
Now, I think of you as being a real chameleon in some of your movies, and I think it's great for you as an actor. I think the only problem would be that people don't necessarily recognize you from role to role, and therefore it might be a little harder to build up a reputation for being Jared Harris.
Ding 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 ding.
That's been a problem.
Absolutely. Good for the craft, crap for the career. it is. In this country, a good actor is confused with a famous actor.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that's made it a longer journey.
Jared Harris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Is that the end?
Yes, it is.
I've enjoyed it. Time just flew by.
Jared Harris speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2001. Harris plays the British ad executive Lane Price in the AMC series Mad Men. Its fourth season begins Sunday. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. We're closing with music from Dutch saxophonist and bandleader Willem Breuker, who's died at the age of 65. For years, he led the Willem Breuker Collective. This was recorded in 1987. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.